I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The holiday shopping season is over, but for some, where to shop is still an issue. A big issue. The battle between big chain stores and independent retailers is being fought in cities across America. And our guests today are clearly the Davids in this battle, representing locally owned businesses. Stacy Mitchell is a researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of The Hometown Advantage. Steve Burkou runs Book People in Austin, and he's president of that city's Independent Business Alliance. Dan Houston is a partner in civic economics, and he's been tracking the impact of independent businesses on local economies. We'll talk about where to shop today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Stacy Mitchell is a researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of The Hometown Advantage. Her most recent publication is called 10 Reasons Why Vermont's Homegrown Economy Matters and 50 Proven Ways to Revive It, published by the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Stacy, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for having me.
What are the trends in locally owned enterprises in America today?
Well, of course, over the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen many locally owned independent businesses disappear, and we've also seen the growth of a number of large chain stores all across the country. But there are many communities now that have realized that there are significant costs associated with large chain retailers, that there are a lot of benefits to maintaining locally owned businesses. And many of these communities are now actively working on various strategies to support and grow their locally owned businesses.
Do you have any numbers, Stacy, to support your comment about the growth of chain retailers versus the decline of small businesses? I'm just wondering if there are any numbers to back that up.
Oh, sure. I can give you a whole bunch. Two chains, Barnes & Noble and Borders, now control about half of all bookstore sales. We've lost 11,000 independent pharmacies since 1990. Three chains, CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, now dominate that sector. Five grocery stores control almost half of all food sales in the country. Office supply stores have disappeared. Blockbuster controls about one out of every three video rentals. And most staggering and of most concern of all is the fact that Walmart, a single retailer, now controls nearly 10% of all retail sales. That's everything we buy, from books and groceries to computers and clothing. One out of every $10 goes to Walmart.
Stacy, you mentioned a number of categories in which we're losing independently owned businesses. But, you know, I have to admit, while my heart may be with independent businesses, for instance, when you talk about an office supply store, I think back 10 years ago, and going into an office supply store was not a very fun experience. I mean, it was sort of a dismal place with lots of boxes of paper and, you know, just things were not displayed. They weren't lit very well. And I go into one of the big brands today in that category, and it's sort of fun to go in. I mean, it makes me want to buy things. It makes me want to try out the latest pen or whatever. And I'm wondering, from a consumer standpoint, Stacy, is the growth of chain retail really such a bad thing?
Well, I think as consumers, we need to be concerned about making sure that there is enough competition in the economy. And right now, what we're seeing is less and less competition. And there's some indications out there that chain stores, their low prices disappear once their competitors have been eliminated and they really control a local market. Certainly, many of the small businesses that have disappeared have gone by the wayside because they weren't very good at what they did, that the experience of going in the store was not great. But we've also lost many very excellent and competitive retailers. And I think that there's a great consumer experience in terms of the kind of customer service that you get, the diversity and unusualness of many of the products that you find at locally owned businesses. And more we're seeing a homogenized selection. We're seeing these large stores where you don't necessarily get that good customer service. And you're dealing with people who are not part of your community and who do not, you know you by name, who don't have all of those connections that really make shopping on Main Street special.
Mm-hmm. But if I go into my local chain retailer, and I'll pick one you've already named, Walgreens. There's one a couple of blocks from my house within walking distance. the people in there, in fact, are part of my neighborhood. The people who work at Walgreens know me. They nod at me. They're as responsive to me as anyone at an independently owned business. Now, certainly, I don't know the owners, but I may not know the owners at an independently owned business either. They may very well have employees, paid employees working for them. So again, just want to stay at this a minute and understand what the real fundamental differences are between differences in terms of the value to a community of a locally owned business versus a chain store. You've talked about variety in merchandise. You've talked about the potential of prices being hiked without competition. Those make sense to me. The friendliness customer service is a little bit tougher. What have you learned?
Well, I would point to the Consumer Reports issue from October of this year, which found by its measure quote, eye-popping margins. Locally owned independent pharmacies provided much superior service and health care than chain pharmacies, and also found that in many cases they offer lower prices on prescription drugs. These are very competitive businesses in many cases. Let's sort of open this up a little bit, because I think one of the things that you're getting at, and one of the most important reasons that we need to think about the role of independent businesses in our communities, is that they contribute a great deal more to our local economies than chain stores do. We did a study, a small study here in Maine this year, and we compared a typical sort of big box retailer's expenditures with that of about a dozen locally owned independent businesses. And we found that big box store, only 14% of the dollars that it was taking in sales were being re-spent somewhere in the state of Maine. The rest left the state, went back to corporate headquarters, went to out-of-state suppliers. Whereas with the locally owned businesses, we found that 45% of their dollars stayed within the local county and another 9% stayed within the state. Those dollars went to support locally owned banks that they banked with. They hired local printers, local accountants. They bought supplies and inventory from other local firms. And so in this way, those local retailers were supporting all of these other businesses and jobs in the community. And so when you go in and you shop at a local business, you're not only supporting that business, but you're sending this ripple of economic benefits through your city. And that helps maintain a much more diverse and stable base of jobs and enterprises in your town. Another really interesting thing that we found in the study is that locally owned businesses give about 4 times as much as a percentage of their overall revenue to charitable causes as do Walmart, and about twice as much as Target does. Locally owned businesses tend to be much more involved in local community issues. They're involved in neighborhood groups, and they give more to local causes because of that connection.
That's a pretty complicated message. Compelling if you can communicate it, but complicated to communicate to consumers. How do you do that?
Well, there are groups that have arisen all over the country in many different kinds of towns and cities where independent businesses are getting together and forming alliances and coalitions specifically for the purpose of pooling their resources and creating these public education or marketing campaigns that talk about the value of supporting locally owned businesses. So they have little messages that they put out on their doors and in advertising and in various ways to get across to the community that when you spend a dollar at a local chain, that dollar tends to stay in the local economy, that there's a community value to doing business with your neighbors. Those kinds of boil down to the core points messages that they're working on getting out, and they've been very effective in doing this.
We're talking about retail, but your organization, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, addresses many different sectors of our economy, energy, agriculture, even sports. How do the things that we're talking about in terms of retail apply to those other sectors?
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance is a national nonprofit organization, and we run a program called the New Rules Project, which is a program that helps communities develop and implement public policies that support their local economies. And so we maintain this clearinghouse on the web of model policies in all of these different sectors that you mentioned, farming, energy, and retail is one of those sectors. Retail, of course, is a very important part of any local economy. And what we found in our research is that right now, many public policies, local, state, and national, are really geared towards encouraging and fostering the growth of large chain retailers, and that in many ways our public policies undermine the health and survival of locally owned businesses. And so we work with communities around the country on changing those policies and implementing new policies that really support locally owned retail.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Stacy Mitchell. She is a researcher for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of the book, The Hometown Advantage. What are some of those public policies, Stacy, that encourage larger enterprises, chain enterprises, and discourage independently owned businesses?
One of the most glaring and obvious is that many cities and counties and even state governments are giving multi-million dollar subsidies and tax breaks to companies like Walmart to build in their town. And those kinds of tax breaks and subsidies are not available typically to locally owned independent businesses. No one knows exactly the total value of these subsidies, but it's in the range of billions of dollars just in the last few years that have gone to chain retailers. We also have planning and zoning policies often locally will encourage and make it easy to build sprawling shopping centers out on the outskirts of town, but make it more difficult and expensive to maintain a small downtown business. And there are also issues with our tax policy that I think really give corporate retailers a leg up and make it harder for locally owned businesses to compete.
Can you summarize easily what those disadvantages in the tax policy are?
Well, two that I'll mention. One is our sales tax policy. Currently, federal law exempts internet retailers like Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com from collecting local and state sales tax, which gives those kinds of companies a 6-8% price advantage over local Main Street businesses. Unwarranted and unfair, I believe. Another one has to do with corporate income taxes. About half the states have policies in place right now that enable national retailers to essentially shelter a portion of their profits that they made in that state from state income taxes. A locally owned business that has an outlet only in one state does not have that option. They have to pay state income taxes on all of their earnings.
Stacy, how is this conversation being organized at a national level? Are you having this dialogue with our national legislators?
Well, I think certainly this is an issue that we are going to see more and more bubbling up to the surface at the national level. Certainly, hundreds of communities just within the last few years have said no to big box retail projects. Many are implementing the kinds of policies that we promote. This is increasingly a subject of dialogue, and we will see that bubble up at the federal level, I believe, as well. But when it comes right down to it, most of the important decisions that we make that affect retail and affect locally owned businesses are made by city governments. They're made at the local level. And so reaching city officials is much more important, I think, right now than engaging in this conversation, say, with Congress members.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've brought retail up again, so I want to go back to it. What is your hometown?
I live in Portland, Maine.
Okay, Portland, Maine. Let's take L.L. Bean. So L.L. Bean's in Freeport, and they open up with one outlet, and it really works well. And they say, you know, we may have something here. So they open in the next city and the next city, and pretty soon they're all over. I have to believe that Freeport in some way is advantaged by that, is they probably are, you know, active in their community. I'm just picking on someone in Maine. May have the facts wrong, but nonetheless, I guess you get the point I'm making. And that is that if Walgreens is headquartered in Chicago, that may be very good for Chicago. In other words, Chicago may want its businesses to be able to expand and grow beyond the city limits, and then that's good at least for one town. So would you have your locally owned business, your locally owned successful business, not be able to expand?
Well, that's a very interesting question. One point I'd make is that there just aren't enough of these big retailers that we can all of our cities can be headquarters to one of them and get the benefits. There just simply aren't enough to go around. I think what we're really talking more about is not something that's black or white, all or nothing, but we're really talking about some degree of balance. We have really lost so many locally owned businesses and veered, I think, really far off in one direction of being dominated by really a handful of bigger retail chains, and that we need to think about refocusing our efforts on bringing back locally owned businesses. Many local retailers will open a second outlet in a neighboring town, or they will enlarge their business into a bigger space, that kind of thing, and still remain very much tied to that local community and very much directly involved in their business. At some point, if they continue to multiply, it becomes an absentee owner situation where you don't have that local connection anymore. And I think that's what we're really talking about, is how do we make sure that at least a significant chunk of our economy is controlled locally by locally owned businesses.
Mm-hmm. What box do you put franchisees in? Are they locally owned businesses, or do you consider them chains?
Well, there's a whole chapter on franchises in my book because it is a tricky issue to negotiate. Typically in any franchise, about 80% of the outlets are locally owned. However, there is a wide difference between different franchise companies as to how much of the control of that business is really vested with the local owner. There are some very bad franchise companies out there where that company headquarters really controls all of the outlets. They reap most of the economic returns, and there really isn't much benefit to the local owner, nor do they really have much say or control over the business. And in that case, I think it's really much closer to a chain. There are other franchise outlets or organizations out there where the local business really is locally owned. They control it. They benefit from some of those national efficiencies and some of those national ideas and ways to organize their business. But they're much more of a locally owned business, and I think in that sense fall more into that category.
You mentioned earlier this notion of new rules. You encourage communities to collaborate with nearby towns to develop a regional approach to megastores. What does such a regional approach look like?
Well, this is a very important thing, is to begin this dialogue with your neighboring communities about developing an overall vision for retail growth. Because a company that's, you know, if you're talking about a large superstore that's going to come into one town, it's going to affect not only that town, but it's going to affect the economies of all the surrounding towns as well as traffic patterns and all sorts of community issues. And so there needs to be a way that all of the towns in a region can have some kind of say over these very large kinds of developments. One of the examples of this that I think is very effective and worth looking at as a model is the Cape Cod Commission, which was created by voters in Cape Cod, which is a region of Massachusetts, in 1990. And any development that comes before a town in the region not only has to be that's a large development over a certain size, not only has to be approved by that town, but also by a regional board. And the regional boards are governed by a set of goals and priorities that are approved by the voters that tell them what kind of development they want to have, and they refer to those priorities in determining whether a particular project is appropriate or not.
Stacy, quickly, if listeners wanted to find cities that are models for promoting locally owned businesses, which cities would they look to?
I think that there are many cities that have gotten a good handle on some aspect of this. There's no one city that I would point to that has gotten it all together at once. There are cities that are doing a very good job at downtown revitalization. The National Main Street Center maintains a great list of those. There are many communities that have done well in getting the right kind of planning and zoning policies in place. We maintain a list of those on our website at newrules.org, and you can log on and actually look at the legislation they've done. There are many communities where independent businesses are very active, like Austin, Bozeman, Boulder, and that are doing great work. And again, you can find out information on our website about all of those places. We also publish an electronic newsletter called the Hometown Advantage Bulletin that tracks all of these innovative things that are going on locally and bi-monthly email editions.
Stacy, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
Stacy Mitchell is author of The Hometown Advantage. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White, who each week brings us the latest news on cities. Also in the second half of our show, we'll talk to Book People President Steve Burku and Dan Houston, partner in civic economics, about a recent study on the impact of independent businesses in Austin. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week Otis provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, you found something that for me is almost unbelievable. Cities are getting a startling offer.
You know, Carol, our parents always told us that if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Well, this is one where cities are being offered something that sounds, on the surface, really too good to be true, and we'll find out if it is. Basically, they're being visited by financiers, big, you know, high finance types, who are coming to them with an offer. And it is, lease us your sewer lines, transit lines, your civic centers, almost anything that's a real expensive asset to build, and we'll give you money for it. And here's the incredible thing. They don't want to do anything with the sewer system or the transit lines or the civic center. They're not going to put their names on it, and they're not going to put anything funny in the sewer system. What they're really buying is tax shelters. You know, I don't know if folks have ever sat through an economics 101 course, but there is something called depreciation, that people are allowed to take on expensive items. If you buy a car for your business, you can depreciate it, and so on. What these people are buying is the depreciation on these expensive civic investments. And then they're chopping them up, the tax shelters up, and selling them to their individual clients. And cities have a lot of these things because they're expensive to buy, but they can't take depreciation on them because cities don't pay taxes. So this is one of those strange transactions where somebody's coming along, claiming a form of ownership of these civic assets, and then using them to shelter federal taxes. The amount of money here is not inconsequential to them. St. Paul, Minnesota, was recently offered $30 million in cash for the use of its sewers.
Wow.
Not to, again, do anything, just to own it so they can have a tax shelter. And transit systems from Boston to New York to Miami and Washington have participated in these things.
Huh. Well, I'll bet we'll see that tax shelter reversed soon.
Yeah, you know, cities have to be careful. It's good legal advice because there got to be some complications in this. But the real damage is being done to the federal budget, and there are some senators who are, not surprisingly, very upset about this. One of them calls it good old-fashioned tax fraud, and wants to close that loophole.
Mm. Well, I guess since cities are not getting much from the feds these days, they have to get the money wherever they can get it.
Yeah,
so I guess
this is a form of federal assistance to the cities, isn't it?
Exactly. Unintended federal assistance. Maybe that's the only way you can get it these days. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Steve Brocou is president of Book People, a big independent bookstore in Austin. He's also president of the Austin Independent Business Alliance. Recently, the Alliance commissioned Dan Houston's firm, Civic Economics, to do a study on the impact of independent retailing on the city, and its results have been cited in land use conflicts in communities all across America. Dan, tell us what is happening nationally in retailing with chain stores versus locally owned retailers.
Well, I think the main thing we're seeing is the obvious, that there's a great influx of chain stores in city after city in the country. And from chain store to chain store, they sort of come in large force all at once in a community. We're facing in Austin a tremendous build-out by Walmart around our metropolitan area. Los Angeles is obviously getting a lot of press for Walmart bringing in the grocery business in a heavily unionized grocery market out there. But what I think is probably more interesting than just the continued growth of the great big box retailers is the local response. There's really a movement out there of business associations, independent merchants alliances, things of that sort, all over the country. And we hear from a new one every week that are organizing to do a couple things. One is to just inform their local consumers that there's a difference and that shopping and supporting your local merchants is important. The other thing that they're doing is trying to influence policymakers to make sure that a lot of city governments seem to view big chain stores as economic development, and they are emphatically not economic development. It's just another retail option in a community, and it has its place, but it certainly shouldn't be a public policy matter to encourage that.
Steve, you are part of that response. You are president of the Austin Independent Business Alliance. What is your organization trying to accomplish?
Well, several things. Certainly one of them is the sort of things Dan has talked about, which is bringing attention to our public policymakers, city council here in Austin, of the value of the local independent businesses that are already here existing and the folly of seeking large chain stores as a sales tax revenue source. Certainly, and then another purpose of the Business Alliance is to educate consumers as to the value of locally owned businesses. And Dan certainly has played a part in that. He provided us with an economic impact analysis that I believe is seminal and is certainly one that is being quoted all over the country, that in our particular case pointed out that one of our chain competitors, who at the time was thinking about moving across the street from us, generates about a little less than one-third the local economic impact that we do, or and basically other local independent businesses do, as opposed to their chain competitors. And those facts are extremely valuable, not only with regard to consumers, who suddenly, I think, are armed with not only the anecdotal or feel-good information that it's better to shop locally just because people have always basically felt that way, probably purely for cultural value in that it maintains a certain uniqueness to whatever community you're in. But there's also a direct economic value to individual consumers to support their local businesses. That money recirculates dramatically in the community, and as far as the public policy makers are concerned, they notice that it recirculates and regenerates even more sales tax revenue. Those are facts that are interesting to have because we've unfortunately in the past just worked on anecdotal information, and this is giving us hard economic information that tells us that these values are values that are worth preserving, whether you're a business owner or a city government or an individual consumer.
Dan, take us through the numbers and the way the numbers work. Why is it that a locally owned business and it's the profits from the locally owned business, why do they circulate more through the community and have more economic impact in a local community than the profits in a or the revenues in a chain store?
There are probably, I guess, three elements to what make the big differences. Number one is that a store like Steve's Book People has a higher portion of its total revenue is spent on local labor, which is absolutely essential. He's putting money on the streets of Austin by hiring people to work in the bookstore. One of the things I like to tell people is if you don't understand the difference between a big chain store and Steve's bookstore, take the elevator to the third floor and you'll see there's an army of people up there that keep the books, that make the decisions about what's going to be ordered, that are creating advertising and copy and T-shirts and bumper stickers and coffee mugs. They're doing things in that third floor that take place in Ann Arbor in the case of another bookstore chain. Or in any chain merchant, they take place in a centralized location. They're actually in your community, in the local market. The other thing that local merchants do that is absolutely essential is that, for the most part at least, the profit stays in your community. People don't notice it in a big city because we're not used to thinking of the merchants of our community as being pillars of the community. Where it really stands out is in a small community. If you go to a small town that has lost that base, you'll see those houses, those forlorn homes where the merchant once was a pillar of the community and was an anchor of the economy in the community. When that's gone, you can't get them back. And small towns it's really clear. You can see it very well there.
You said there were three things, and I'm curious about the third thing that really makes the difference.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it was particularly dramatic in the music business in Austin, is local procurement. We found that the local merchants, at least in the case study we did in Austin, are procuring a large portion of their product base locally. You know, Steve isn't buying a lot of books from local publishing houses because we don't have a lot of them, but he's buying a lot of books from local authors, and he's encouraging people to buy those books. More dramatically, we found at Waterloo, a record store in Austin, a tremendous quantity of music that's produced and recorded locally. I mean, we like to say the only thing that's imported on a Weary Boys CD in Austin is the plastic of the CD itself. Everything else about that album is local, and all of that money is dropped locally.
What prompted the study?
This is Steve. We were talking among ourselves, several of the businesses. A couple of us, Waterloo, who Dan mentioned, and Book People, were faced with a chain competitor for both of us coming in across the street. We discovered that there were city incentives being granted to the development for the building that would be occupied later by the chain store. We felt that since we were spending our own tax dollars to subsidize a building for a competitor, that we should at least find out realistically what the economic impact would be of this competitor coming across the street from us. Would it in fact be what the city had fantasized, which was a source of new sales tax revenue because these people were coming across the street? That is one of the incredible fallacies nationwide with city planners and chain development, is they somehow believe that this creates more sales tax revenue, as opposed to what reality tells us actually happens, which is it just simply redistributes it from one place to another. But in the process of trying to figure that out and actually come up with something that we could talk to the city about in our opposition to these incentives, we decided that it would be good to actually know factually what the economic impact might be. And that's where Dan came in and provided us with the economic impact analysis. He, in the study that was done, very generously assumed that the new chain store would create 50% more business, which is probably a very generous assumption. But even with that, over a five-year period, we were able to show the city council here that assuming that they created this 50% extra business, the city would still lose money on the project in terms of overall revenue and overall economic impact here locally. And that's a pretty dramatic demonstration to people who are deciding whether or not to give someone money to have this project go forward. We certainly felt it was incredibly valuable, and it obviously was valuable, and that the city in the first place delayed any sort of incentive package. And secondly, during the delay period, the chain store withdrew from its lease and decided to back out, probably due to overwhelming opposition to their coming, frankly. And then following that, the city basically redesigned its entire incentive plans, how they would grant incentives, what the basis would be, how they would do it, what they would do to incentivize a business, what businesses would be incentivized. So it was extremely valuable in that it caused our city to basically reevaluate how this would work, and we hope come up with a better way.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter any resentment at all from people who wanted the option of shopping at that competitor?
Well, not really, because this is a medium-sized city, and we already have eight of the competitor's stores in the community to choose from anyhow.
Mm.
This was simply an extra location. It was not. This was not going to be a new thing arriving in town that had never been here before.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Steve Berkue, who is president of Book People in Austin, and he's also heads the Austin Independent Business Alliance, and Dan Houston, who is a partner in Civic Economics. Dan, this issue of sales tax is pretty interesting, and the projection of sales tax. And one of the things that a lot of communities get into is that, in Austin's case, Austin may have it's getting its share of sales tax from its retailers, whoever they may be, however they may be owned. But the next community is not. And so the next community says, well, we want our share of the sales tax, too, so we'll make sure that development is possible, and perhaps we'll even provide incentives because we're not cannibalizing anything in our municipality within our taxing limits. But in fact, the region as a whole, it's not a net new gain to the region. How do you work through some of those boundary issues when you're looking at communities facing these decisions?
You've hit on probably the greatest challenge, not just in planning for retail and land use issues, but just nearly anything that affects municipal tax revenue, which is competition within a metropolitan area for what is essentially a fixed, if growing, pie. You're not going to increase the pie by having a new Walmart in a given suburb. It's still going to be the same amount of spending. You've just changed where it happens. And in some states, where California is the notable example, where sales tax is the dominant way to fund most municipal activities, that battle between communities is rather intense, and they really have to give up most things, quality of life issues, transportation issues, social service issues, because getting the new superstore in your community is the secret to actually having a city government that's funded at all. In Texas, we're not that desperate. There are folks in Austin that will tell you we are that desperate. There are folks in the city of New Orleans tell you they're that desperate for sales tax revenue that they have to lure it back inside the city limits of the core city. But ultimately, we have to remember that it's a regional economy, that people for the most part, don't make the decisions based on city limits. So, you have to keep that in mind. In Austin, what's really striking, however, is that if you look at the population changes over time, yeah, Austin is losing, in terms of the share of total sales tax revenue in the metropolitan area, it's not surprising that we're losing that. And I'm sure that's true in Memphis. It's true in every central city that has suburbs, because growth happens outside the central city for the most part. And so as a share of total metropolitan sales tax, it does decline. Austin's total sales tax revenue share of the metropolitan sales tax revenue is not declining as fast as our share of population, meaning that we're doing great in Austin. Stores like Steve's get suburbanites coming into town to spend money. Why? Because it's better and it's different. We could offer exactly what they offer in the suburbs in a central city, but people from the suburbs aren't going to drive in on purpose to go to a different Walmart. They will drive into the city to go to a different store entirely, something that's not available in their community. And that's the very fight they're having in New Orleans today. I think you probably had a chance to see that one as well. You know, the city is trying to lure a Walmart in with the hope that suburbanites will shop at the Walmart or that city people will stop driving out to the Walmart, when in reality, what's attractive in New Orleans is that people from all over the country go to New Orleans to shop at things that are not available anywhere else, and locals treasure that as well.
Steve, you sell books and gifts online. Your gift page is fabulous. I love your monkey salt and pepper shakers. But I presume you want to sell your merchandise to people everywhere. So your online store probably is, taking business away from a bookstore somewhere else. How does the internet fit into this calculation about locally owned retailers?
I don't think it's that complex in a way. I think that depends on the item you're selling, obviously. We sell books online, so of course they're available to someone anywhere in the United States. But realistically, what we're selling online, and what I, certainly in the book business, what most bookstores, other than Amazon, who is a national retailer of massive size, is selling, what most of us are selling are things that we have that are unique that the other stores don't have, that you can't buy readily online. Frankly, most of our sales online go to local customers who just don't want to wait around when they get to the store, so they like to have everything paid for and waiting for them so they can come in, pick it up, and do it on their lunch hour and not have to spend extra time with that particular purchase. It's not a real major issue with us. There's a major, of course, national issue with internet sales. It's just whether or not you have to collect sales tax and who's collecting sales tax and whether the sales tax collection should be mandated for every business online. I support sales tax collection, frankly. Since we collect it here, we believe that everyone should collect it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. It raises a question, your internet sales. I mean, with the surge of online shopping and given the general agreement that America has more stores than can be supported and commercially zoned property, Dan, I'm curious, in your work with cities, have you ever thought about what would happen if we had a serious reduction in the number of stores in our cities? I mean, how do you think life in cities would be affected?
Well, I'll tell you, a great place to take a look at how that plays out is Detroit, Michigan, which by any reasonable measure had more commercial zoning starting in the 20s than even at its peak population could ever have been supported. And they've always had long stretches of underused commercial space in Detroit. And, of course, today that's significantly exacerbated from the past. It gives you a feel for what the problem is, that vacant storefronts are urban killers. They drain vitality from everything around them. You know, in a city like Detroit, the policy is to try to get rid of some of them and put something else on that property. And it's a good possibility that in the coming years, as internet purchasing and the UPS man become a big part of our retail lives, that we will have to deal with vacant storefronts in even healthy cities. And cities are going to have to begin planning for that. Suburban communities have already encountered this, you know, where they've zoned for every one-mile major intersection has two grocery stores and two drug stores and God only knows what else out there, three dry cleaners, that the market isn't there to support them, even in thriving suburban communities. And that's posed a problem for them to get those redeveloped.
I just keep wondering, what will be the alternative? I mean, stores make a city lively and vibrant, and there's something to walk by, and there's something to hang out in and meet your friends in and be entertained, if you will. You know, I'm wondering what will take the place, if anything could take the place of the role that stores play in a city today.
I think in our society that the stores are going to remain a very important part of what we do. We don't have the kind of lifestyle in the United States that they have in, for example, Latin countries, some others where there's lots of street life and people walking around talking to each other all the time. One of the experiences I believe people seek when they go to stores where they are greeted by people in a one-on-one environment is they're looking for some sort of human experience along with just buying something. Yes, we can all buy pretty much anything online and not ever have to deal with a human being anywhere. But I think that many people want to actually deal with a human being and want to know that there's someone who maybe could help them with their purchase if necessary, or at least just interact with them so that they have some feeling that they're dealing with other people. I think that because of the nature of our society, that's going to continue well into the future because we certainly aren't set up to be a pedestrian society with dense, walkable cities in many places in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Dan, there's a larger city within which a local economy operates, and every day we're hearing news of American companies moving creative occupations offshore. In an economy where jobs are moving globally to cheaper locations, and we're not talking just blue-collar jobs or call centers, but R&D jobs, technology jobs. In that environment, Dan, what adds value to U.S. cities? Are there industries or occupations in which higher-cost cities are better able to compete?
Well, I tell you, doing some economic development planning work in New York State one time, every single meeting we ever held, somebody would say, this is too expensive, it's an awfully expensive place. That's the standard refrain in New York State. Government takes too much money, it costs too much money to buy housing to do anything. And my answer is that, you know, to the extent that your cost of living is too high, that's a reflection that the market values your community highly. People want to be in Austin, our housing is expensive. In New York State, do people get something for their tax revenue? Yes, they do. They get better schools than the rest of us, frankly.
Dan, that's clearly been true, and I agree with you. And yet it seems like the game may be changing. I mean, again, when IBM pulls jobs out of a number of high-quality, high-amenity U.S. cities and moves them to Bangalore, moves them to China for cost, for reasons of cost, then how should cities think about remaking themselves for this rapidly changing economy?
The recent IBM announcement, I think, is probably really hitting a lot of people right now, and it certainly strikes a chord in Austin where suddenly, in the last 5 years, Bangalore has become a major competitor of this city. We're not just trying to compete with San Jose and Dallas. We're competing with Dublin and Bangalore as well now. And obviously, we're not going to beat India on cost for a long time. As an economist, I have to have a little faith that markets and specializations work themselves out over time, although it certainly is a crisis. I mean, one of the things that we get paid to do is go into communities that are facing what we call economic adjustment, which is a nice word for the textile mill closed, because we simply can't make fabric in this country competitively anymore. We have a hard time manufacturing a lot of things. And, you know, over time now, if we're going to find that's true equally of sort of the creative class jobs that we've been discussing a lot in the last couple of years, that's going to be a much bigger crisis for us. Because we're counting on those creative class jobs, those jobs that require college educations, to drive our American economy. And, you know, the fact is that economies have to reformulate what they do best periodically. And you know, a city like Pittsburgh is a great example. They only did the one thing for a long time, and they did it very well, but it was expensive to do it there, and it stopped happening. And the city reinvented itself. Now, the question is, what happens next if Pittsburgh can't compete with Bangalore for what they're trying to do in Pittsburgh? That's a valid question. I think in the long run, you know, we're still going to continue winning in this country in a lot of ways, in part because we have to provide services to one another within our economy.
Mm-hmm. Steve, as a passionate independent, you've promoted the Keep Austin Weird campaign. It's been talked about all over the country. How do you, in fact, keep Austin weird? How is it, and what is the value of weirdness?
Weirdness is, I guess, in the eyes of the weird person. Austin, in Austin, weird was a concept that people immediately thought was a way to express our uniqueness and what we thought was cool about Austin. weird may not be the right adjective for everywhere. It could be better said in some other way in some other place. But the point is we have a very receptive citizenry to keeping the cultural values of the city together. The city has had an erosion of many of the things that many of us who've been here for decades thought were cool about the city many years ago. But nevertheless, a lot of it is still here. And so keeping Austin weird, we thought, expressed the kind of atmosphere of the city, the little bit of sense of humor that we certainly try to maintain about ourselves and not taking all of this too seriously or taking ourselves too seriously, but nevertheless wanting very much for where we live to be unique, which is, by the way, a concept I don't believe that is very unique to us. I think everybody wants where they live to be unique and special, and it is to each person in each place that where they are, because that's why they're there, presumably. So what keeps these places unique? Well, there's one thing that's simple, that's landscape, and that won't change no matter what anybody does. But outside the landscape, there's really nothing much that keeps cities unique except the atmosphere that's generated by, I think, locally owned businesses, the mix of restaurants, the kind of folks that want to be there partaking of what is already available in whatever city it happens to be. In Austin, we were fortunate in having a lot of people who were very interested in keeping not only their parts of Austin, but the whole city unique. And that has led to a tremendous acceptance of this Keep Austin Weird as a good thing to have. I don't know how many businesses now have T-shirts with Keep Austin Weird on the back and their name on the front. Probably 70 or 80 different businesses here. I mean, you see these T-shirts all over town. I know that at my store, Waterloo Records and Book People Together put out a little bumper sticker with both our names on it, and Keep Austin Weird, Support Local Businesses in the middle. We started this a mere 13 months ago, and we've given away 80,000 of them in the year, 13 months.
Dan, Steve, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Steve Berku is president of the Austin Independent Business Alliance, and Dan Houston is a partner in civic economics. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. While some of us are deciding whether to shop locally, City View's commentator Walker Smith has decided to stop shopping altogether, at least when it comes to Christmas gifts.
My wife and I have decided to stop buying Christmas presents. We're not going to stop giving Christmas presents, but we are going to stop buying them. Instead, we are going to make them ourselves. For friends and acquaintances, we will make cards to send, hand-lettered and self-composed, however sloppy or cliched they may turn out to be. For family, we will do more. Perhaps we will write a story and illustrate it with cutouts from old magazines or downloads from the internet. Perhaps we will piece together a scrapbook of the year just passed, or fill a treasure box with trinkets and homemade charms. We aren't very good at poems or pictures or songs, but maybe we'll do that anyway. Or maybe we'll promise to visit an extra weekend or two during the year, or maybe we'll organize a family night out. I don't know exactly what we'll decide on, but I do know it will be something from our hands and our hearts, not something from the store. I know this sounds pretty silly, especially coming from me, a marketing consultant, but there is something even sillier, and that is continuing to give people things they don't need, or even worse, things that won't make them happy. There's not much that we Americans lack anymore. There are lots of things we don't have, and money is tight. But our basic quality of life is higher than ever, and far better than that for most people around the world. In 2002, New York Times writer Camille Sweeney interviewed families with a household income equal to the national average. Budgets were tight, but every single family she interviewed had recently purchased at least one, and often two, luxury items, such as a powerboat, a widescreen TV, a vacation home, a pool, a luxury SUV, or an exclusive vacation. Average household size has dropped from 3.14 in 1970 to 2.66 today. Over this same period, real household income rose, as did the number of cars and the total square feet in an average house. With fewer people per household, this translates into a lot more money, more room, and more mobility per person. In fact, the number of self-storage units has tripled since the mid-80s. It is literally true that as hard as it is to get from paycheck to paycheck, we have so much stuff that there's no place left to put it. But despite living in the midst of surplus and superabundance, we don't feel any better. Our collective sense of well-being has not budged in 50 years. More stuff, but no more happiness. Because it turns out that stuff is only about comfort. Happiness is about relationships. So my wife and I have decided to shift our Christmas giving from stuff to relationships. We want to learn from what psychologists now know and what we have felt in our guts for a long time. Our friends and family have lots of things, indeed too many things, but they can always use more care and nurturing. And that's what we want to give them from now on. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelevich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, listen to archive shows, and you can register for our weekly newsletter. It recaps our discussion here and provides all the links you need to our guest. Thanks to Nikki Shields at Maine Public Radio, David Alvarez at KUT, and Susanna Capelluto at Georgia Public Radio for their production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.